From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells. Our next guest, Jason Torchinsky. He's the star of a YouTube program, Jason Drives, and the senior editor of the website, Jalopnik, and a producer of Jay Leno's Garage. He comes with a witty and insightful guide to self-driving cars and the road ahead. Now, self-driving cars, they sound fantastical and futuristic and a whole bunch of other things, but they'll soon be on every street in America. Whether it's Tesla's Autopilot, Google's Waymo, Mercedes' Distronic, or Uber's modified Volvos, companies around the world are developing autonomous cars. But why? And what will they mean for the auto industry? And what will they mean for us? Jason Torchinsky gives us the scoop this morning. Jason, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's good to have you. Before we talk about autonomous vehicles, can we talk about horses and donkeys and camels and muscular
sure.
animals like that?
So yeah, because they were our first, at least semi-autonomous vehicles that humans use. You know, driving, riding a horse and cart or buggy, you're not fully driving. The horse understands how to do lane keeping. It understands emergency braking. It knows not to walk off cliffs. We weren't really driving. We were just kind of guiding, giving some directional input to these animals, who I'm told are fully autonomous when they're not doing work with us. Our human driving, like with the car as an actual prosthetic to magnify physical motions that we make and where you're in charge of every action of that car, is actually pretty short-lived over the span of human history. Most of the time, we've been in semi-autonomous vehicles.
Yeah. Well, we are going to talk about autonomous vehicles, but I just have to ask you one other question, which is off the rail a little bit. How come boat cars never made it?
Boat cars? Like amphibious cars?
Yeah. I mean,
I've driven big. They do exist. There are some. The most famous one is probably the Amphicar. I've driven them on land and in the water. At the moment where they really shine is the moment where you drive from land right into water. That one moment, there is nothing like them. They are by far the greatest vehicles ever. But the problem is they generally don't make that great cars and they don't make that great boats. So while they're fun, you'd have to have a really specific reason. Like you lived on an island and your entire commute was all rivers and estuaries and, you know, and that kind of thing. You'd have to really need something to go from land to water. But they're great at that one thing. It's just, there's a lot more to maintain than in a regular car. If you're really into boats, chances are you probably just want a boat. If you're really into cars, you probably just want a car. But, I don't know, I feel like they deserve another shot. I feel like there's a market for a good mass market amphibious vehicle because they are fun.
You know, Jason, maybe they could be reimagined because I agree with you, that moment that they enter the water is exciting, but then within 5 minutes, a wave comes over the windshield and swamps it.
Yeah, they're probably best not in, like, ocean context. They're probably best in more like rivers and lakes, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm taking issue with this conversation because I was just on a stand-up paddleboard the other day when I was vacationing in Seattle on Lake Union, and there that went right by me, almost mowed me over, was an amphibious car. Ooh. You know the what are the
what
cars
color
called? The it was green, like battleship green,
yeah.
And it was in the tourist industry they have those where you
duck.
Yeah, the duck. There we go. So
yeah,
they
sure.
exist.
Yeah, that was a famous ex-military vehicle.
Yeah, not very James Bond like, so not really fun, but you know, the tourists look like they were having a blast, almost running me over.
We see them every year
when
the duck tours in Boston take the Boston Patriots around after winning a Super Bowl. They have all these duck boats, and it's they're part of the parade.
I am certainly not saying they're not fun, because they are. They're a blast. I'm pro amphibious car. I want to make sure that's absolutely clear here. I am very pro amphibious vehicle.
So
I don't want anybody to think I'm not.
Well, I From what I've learned about you in the last few days, Jason, I think you are a pro just about any type of car. Where does this intense love for automation come from? It seems like, you know, you're a historian and you know what's going on right now. Where did it come from?
Well, I've always loved cars, partially because they're the most irrational things we buy. Cars are not rational purchases. Cars have never been rational, and I don't think they ever will be. They're probably the biggest, most expensive purchase you're likely to make in your life, multiple times in your life, for reasons that aren't entirely practical. They're closer to fashion than they are the other things we buy. You can have a refrigerator for 30 years, and when you get rid of it, you barely care. But when you get rid of a car you've had for a long time, people feel emotional about them. We have real bonds with our cars that transcend the way we deal with most other machines in our lives. And they've always, you know, it's always struck me. And I've always had very close relationships with my cars. Cars are, they're freedom. They're a way to express who you are. They're, you know, like I describe it as like a prosthetic, magnify your own physical abilities. They're just fun. They're just the kind of machines that are just rewarding to have and people associate a lot of themselves with. They can literally change how your life is. And there's so few things in our life that are actually genuinely like that. You know, they're great. If they were built rationally, you know, there'd be like two basic kinds of car and all parts would be interchangeable and you'd have the same basic drivetrain and vehicle that would handle, you know, there'd be like a pickup variant or a people mover variant or an economy variant, but that'd be it. But that's not how it works at all. There's all kinds of ridiculous cars. And, you know, like the fact that you can go out today and buy a four-door sedan that's got 707 horsepower is absolutely absurd. There is zero rational reason for it. And yet that's something you can do if you felt like it.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Jason Torchinsky. He has written Robot Take the Wheel, The Road to Autonomous Cars and the Lost Art of Driving. Jason, take us through the five levels of automation, including level zero, which is no automation, and give us just a brief description of each of the levels. And when you get down to level two, three, four, and five, kind of tell us where we are at those various levels.
Sure. Yeah. So, the Society of Automotive Engineers came up with these standards for autonomy levels. Zero, of course, is basically like all the crap I drive, my old 73 Beetle or whatever. It's manual everything. Manual shifter, manual steering, manual everything. Level one is probably what most people have. That's a car with likely an automatic transmission and perhaps cruise control. There's a little bit of control. Maybe there'd be possibly you could count even cars with, like the distance range keeping cruise control. But for the most part, just basic, fairly basic stuff of most cars. Level two is semi-autonomy. And level two is the highest level of autonomy for a car you can actually go out and buy today. And I feel like this is an important point because a lot of people believe that, say, Tesla's Autopilot, for example, is a fully autonomous system. And it is most certainly not. It is semi-autonomous. So what level two means, it's a car that can do things like lane keeping. It can do, keep a distance from a car in front of it. If you stand lines, it can even, you can even have a level two system that can change lanes, pass cars, and take an exit even in some cases. It can do a fair amount of driving, but you have to be ready. You as a driver have to be ready to take over at any moment. If it fails, if it loses information, if it's got a sensor that it can't get readings from the way it wants, it will fail and it will pass control to the driver immediately, which means the driver has to remain alert and ready to take over the vehicle at a moment's notice, which is why most of these systems require some method of ensuring that that's the case. Tesla, for example, requires you to have your hands physically on the steering wheel. GM's Super Cruise system uses a camera watching your eyes and face to make sure you're actually paying attention to the road. So these are not autonomous by any means. And I feel like people get into a lot of trouble because whenever you see a video of somebody in a Tesla on autopilot sleeping in their car on the highway, that's an incredibly bad idea. Because even though it does maybe 80% of the driving, at any moment it could click off and you could end up dead, as several people have.
And
so that's level two.
And before you go to level 3, 4, and 5, let me just ask a quick question. Is the reason that people believe that these vehicles could be or are fully autonomous, is that because of marketing, or is that because they don't understand the capabilities?
I think it's both. Marketing is a huge factor. On Tesla's website, they actually describe their vehicles as being, having full self-driving hardware. They refer to it as fully self-driving in several places, which is not true. It is deceptive, and I think it's actually a big problem. I have a whole chapter basically just called Semi-Autonomy is Stupid that covers all of this, because it's a bad idea, and marketing it as though it is autonomous is a problem. And I've dealt with Tesla's PR people, and I'm not even very confident that they even perceive this as big a problem as it is. When I talked about issues of people sleeping at the wheel, a Tesla PR person I was speaking with mentioned that how much safer the car is than a conventional car if you were to fall asleep at the wheel. And while that's true, that's completely missing the point.
Yeah.
And it's a dangerous attitude. And I think it's also a bad idea because humans are just not designed to work that way. If you have something that's doing 80% of the work for you, especially for a kind of a potentially monotonous task like driving a car on a highway, we are not built to just be ready to take over at any moment. Our instinct and the way we work is that we're going to let the car do the work once we trust it, and we're not going to try to take over. That's just not how we are. We're going to look at our phone, we're going to sleep, we're going to relax. Mm-hmm. It's doing enough of the work that you can easily be lulled into believing it's doing everything, and it's just not. So yeah, it's a combination of marketing that borders on the deceptive and human nature that just really isn't well suited to this strange gray area between being in control and giving up control.
Yeah, and so then we move into conditional, high, and full automation. So what is conditional?
Yeah, so
that sounds sort of like partial.
Well, yeah, I mean, level three is similar to level two, except it's capable of failing over in a safe way. Like in level two, where if there's an issue where the car can't react properly, it just wants you to take over immediately. Level three is supposed to provide a means for it to safely get out of the way, get to the side of the road, stop, and then, reassess. Level four is basically full automation, except it's in a controlled environment. Level four is full automation within like a geofenced area, an area where the chaos of the world is kept a little bit at bay and controlled. I've been in a few cars like these, they work great in the environments that they're designed for, but as soon as you take them out into the real world, they're not going to be able to handle it. And level five is still hypothetical. We don't really have any, certainly no production examples of this, and I don't think this is ready. Level five would be fully autonomous, meaning you get in the car wherever you are, you tell it where you want to go, and then it does everything. Level five systems, they deal with all of the chaos of the world, and I think they're going to prove extremely difficult to get there, and I feel like we're at least a decade away from that.
A decade away from that. Very interesting. Well, Jason, we hear in the media about the failures, right? The fails that occur with Tesla or whatever car company that's coming out with either partial or semi-autonomous cars. And I have a feeling that you can tell us what the really great things are currently that are not being reported on, the things that we should appreciate and look forward to. And one of those that I think of right away is with, I guess it would be maybe step two, with the lane keeping. I cannot wait for teenagers to have those alerts pop on when they're tailgating. Something about my kids when they were teens, that they just thought tailgating was fine. But those kinds of alerts, really beneficial.
Well, I think what you're going to actually see, and this, I don't mean to sound negative, but I think we're going to see an erosion of driver skill with all these driver aids. With the standard set of driver aids that almost every modern, mid-range and up car comes with, like lane keeping, dynamic cruise control, that kind of thing, that lets you be a much crappier driver than you normally would be able to, because it does smooth out a lot of the rough edges. So I think as long as, young people and teens are kept in cars like that, they'll be fine. But I don't think we're going to fully realize how much they're going to be relying on those systems until you try to stick them in an older car without those systems.
Yeah.
I've driven, you know, a lot of modern cars that have these things, and you can really, the amount of, you can really be a much worse driver, and it's not as noticeable. And I think if you're growing up and that's what you're used to, your driving skills are not going to develop in the same way because you have so many extra assists for it. And I think if we're just talking about pure skill, are they going to be better drivers? No. I think the car may be able to do things to help keep them to be better. Warnings if you're tailgating, or, you know, dynamic cruise that just basically keeps you from tailgating. Most cars have an emergency brake and stop system, so if you're not paying attention, the car will automatically brake for you. But these are all things that drivers will not be trained to do. They will be relying on the car to handle a lot of the more complex or emergency situations for them. So they're not going to make us better drivers. They're going to be better tools that make the end result better, perhaps, than it was, because we take a significant part of the human error out of the equation. But as far as how well we drive ourselves, we're not going to improve at all. It'll be the opposite.
Point well made. However, I just have to say, I love that how much they keep peace in the family. I don't have to tell my husband how to drive and how to be more conscientious when the car is telling him. I can just sit over there and be quiet.
Half that work. Yeah. I'm not saying this is a bad thing. If you have a car with these tools, that's fantastic. The end result is, you know, safer driving. Absolutely, no question. It depends on how important is it to you that your kid can drive, you know, an old manual car if they need to, something without any. Maybe it matters to you, and maybe you're in a position where you feel like they're never going to be in a car like that, so who cares? I don't know. I think for me it would matter, because I think the cars, you know, that I have around that when my kid's ready to drive, is likely to drive, are probably not going to have those systems. So I want to make sure he knows how to do it. But for most people, I don't necessarily know that that's even a priority or should be.
So for our listeners, let me just mention that Robot Take the Wheel, The Road to Autonomous Cars and the Lost Art of Driving, is a very comprehensive book. It's a lot of fun to read. And you've got some interesting illustrations, and I'll just throw this out as a tease. There's even a little piece on how B.F. Skinner trained pigeons in a nose of a missile to be able to guide the missile to its intended target, which is absolutely bizarre. And you even included a picture of the pigeons in the missile. So, I mean, this book's got a lot of stuff in it, Jason, okay?
I'm glad you like that, 'cause that's one of my favorite things. I love this. I mean, in an era before we had really effective computers and computer vision systems, pigeons are handling all that stuff really well, and they're a hell of a lot cheaper to make. So training them and using them actually made a fair amount of sense, and they were pretty good at it, is the amazing thing. A pigeon is good at tracking a target, and if you can use a few to guide something, why not?
So if you can teach through pictures, a pigeon what the intended target is, and you put them in the nose cone with these little baby pigeon windows, and they're looking out the window, and when the pigeon on that side of the missile sees the target, they peck something, and the missile heads that way? Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, basically there were three windows and three pigeons, and the pigeons were just trained to peck at the target. So in each window, I think they had a sensor in there, pretty simple sensor. And so if it was veering away from the target, the pigeon, say it was veering off too far to the right, the pigeon in the left window would peck the target, and it would send a signal to adjust the rudder so it would go more towards the target. And it was very crude and simple, but it worked. And between the three of them, it just, you know, each one kept pecking, and they averaged out the where the target was, and it actually worked pretty well. But I think it just seemed a little too ridiculous for anybody to seriously catch on. But
yeah,
I think it did work.
And I don't think there are pigeons in any of these autonomous vehicles. And I do say vehicle versus car, because we'll talk about that in a minute, about why we shouldn't imagine these things just as cars. But let's just talk about, not the pigeons, but the real technology. We all know and familiar with GPS. It helps us. We understand cameras and their ability to be able to take us places. We've heard of LIDAR before, light detection and ranging. Maybe you can talk about that and then talk about what is called Sensor Fusion 33, bringing the whole thing together.
Yeah, so, I mean, autonomous vehicles are the ones we're working on now. They need, we do this job with a pair of cameras in a swivelable platform we call our eyes and our head. And we use our ears and other things as well. And we have thousands of years of human evolution that helps us watch things and track things and understand what things are on the road. And a lot of our culture actually factors into this too. So for a car, we have to have, you have to visually be able to see what's in front of it, which is where cameras come in. There's radar, which is used for distance assessment, especially for things like dynamic cruise. There's ultrasonic sensors, which kind of do more fine-tuning of sensor data to get positioning ideas of what objects are around the car. GPS gives a general sense of where the car is and where it's heading. And LIDAR gives, it's like paints an area with laser light, and it gives a good 360 view of the environment around it. Now, Tesla famously does not want to use LIDAR, I think partially for cost reasons, and I think for some aesthetics, because I think actually that Elon Musk just doesn't like the way those big, you know, LIDAR domes look on the roof. But I think LIDAR is actually pretty important also. I think redundancy is going to be important for these things because, you know, you are in a moving vehicle, and if something fails, you want to be ready. And, you know, there's, you've got to keep in mind, you know, there's camera lenses, usually in front of the rearview mirror on most cars, and then there's some on the sides for blind spot monitoring. If any of these gets dirty, you know, if you drive through a mud puddle or they get splashed or the weather is bad,
you're in trouble.
It can disable your vision system on a car, you know, pretty dramatically.
And
so, you know, you've got basically a whole set of sensors around the car to give it a sense of its environment, and then you have to have a lot of computing technology to process what it's seeing.
Bring it all together.
So you're getting like two-dimensional images coming in via cameras. It's got to process what things are where. It needs to understand what's a car, what's a bicycle, what's a person. And modern systems do this. They, you know, a lot of it's based on proportions of objects, and there's bounding boxes. They still get confused by things like a picture of a bicycle on a van. MIT did a study, and they found it was very easy to confuse autonomous cars with a van that had a wrap on it with a picture of a bicycle on it.
Right. Jason, I do have to interrupt you for a second. I'm sorry.
Yes,
we only have
ahead.
about 20 seconds left before we have to you go. So
to finish up, buy the book. It's got all kinds of good stuff in there. And I go through all this stuff in painful detail.
Jason Torchinsky. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.